the Biden administration did more than any presidential administration, probably since Franklin D. Roosevelt, to try to be responsive to rural places. And they had all of these place-based policies for distressed counties in, as you say, the Inflation Reduction Act, and in the CHIPS and Science Act, and in the infrastructure law. And yet, it seems like nobody really knew about it. Was it that, you know, policies never really got off the ground, that they didn't get administered, or was no one there to connect the dots and to say to voters, look, we have this great new policy that's helping our area, and in fact, you know, the Democrats got this over the finish line, and Joe Biden signed it into law.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and as listeners know, one recurring theme of this show since we started has been the rural-urban divide, topics emanating off of that, such as the working class voters and a historic shift and realignment moving from Democratic to Republican. Rural areas have a preponderance of working class voters, which is defined as those without college degrees. That's the accepted definition. And I've spent a lot of time talking to experts in this field throughout the years, people who've written books. And there's a new one out that's, I think, very, very good and worth your time, because it talks about it's based on a lot of data analysis, which is always good to back up opinions. And I think it's got some warning signs about the future of our democracy. Not to be too alarming, but I do think there's a legitimate case to be made. You're going to hear about it today. My guest is a co-author of the book. She's Suzanne Mettler. And the book is called Rural versus Urban, The Growing Divide That Threatened Democracy. Her co-author is Trevor Brown. This book just came out, and I think it's worth a read. And I hope you get interested enough from this podcast to maybe go get a copy. Suzanne, thanks so much for taking the time to be with me today.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Robin. Thanks for inviting me.
You know, I'm just going to walk you through this and start with, I think there's a perception among people that a lot of this divide in our country started with Donald Trump. And I've observed in my years politics and doing this show that that's not the case, but you've actually got some good solid data to kind of refute that. I'd like you to start there today, if you would, please.
Yeah, this is really fascinating to us. If you look back to as recently as the early 1990s, the United States did not have a rural-urban divide that was nationwide. And, you know, through the middle of the 20th century, we charted out with every presidential elections, rural and urban voters voted very similarly for the winning candidate. There was usually a 2 percentage point gap between rural and urban voters. And then in the late 90s, this gap starts to grow, and it grows from 2 percentage points in the 1992 election to over 20 percentage points in the last two presidential elections, 2020 and 2024. And it grows in every region of the country. Some people think, oh, it must just be about the South changing, but no, it's actually grown in the Midwest more than in the South, about 22 percentage points now. And the West and the Northeast as well. And it's grown in almost every state. Most states in the country now have a pretty big rural-urban divide. So to us as political scientists, it's kind of a puzzle. Like, what happened? Here you had people who were, you know, politically all kind of moving together, and then they move apart. And what's happened is that rural areas all over the United States have moved very strongly towards supporting the Republican Party. Democrats in the most densely populated cities had long been supporting Democrats, like really since the New Deal. But then other areas of smaller cities and suburbs and so on, those have become more solidly Democratic supporting since the 90s. So you've got this split.
Well, I, because I talk to a lot of people that say, Trump, was the main force behind this. And I've seen other evidence, or not evidence, but election returns in my own work that have shown that not to be the case. He certainly took advantage of it, but that's why it was refreshing to see some data, some solid data behind what I've always thought. But I thought it was really interesting, and I think it was the second chapter of the book talked about some of the economic factors that led to this. And boy, we've seen that around here in our region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois and our two main industries. But talk about what you found there and the evidence you had to kind of back it off.
Yeah, so to us, this, we start investigating, well, what changed that drove this rural urban divide? And, first I should say that from the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the New Deal, all the way up through the 1980s, rural people really, in many areas, stuck with the Democratic Party, or they at least were willing to vote split ticket, even if they were, tended more typically to vote for Republicans. And in the New Deal, people felt that the Democratic Party was there for them in economic policies that really helped them out. And they re remained feeling that the Democratic Party had their backs for all of those decades. So what changed in the 1990s? We find that in counties, so we do all of this data analysis. We collect data on all 3,143 counties all over the country, and we look at them from 1976 to 2020. And what we find is that in the late 90s and early 2000s, rural counties that were losing jobs, or where there was, stagnant or negative job growth, as well as those counties that were losing population, both of those types of counties moved toward Republican voting in presidential elections. So then, we investigate, well, what's going on there? And of course, it will be no surprise to your listeners. There's various trends. There were from the 1980s on, you had the closure of a lot of family farms with the rise of agribusiness. Then there's also the decline of mining and other kind of extractive industries. Some of it's due to technology, some to policy changes. So you've counties that rely upon those kinds of jobs lost out. And then in the 1990s and early 2000s, you have deindustrialization hitting rural areas. It had really been hitting urban areas earlier, but it was by the late 20th, early 21st century, you have the closing of so many plants that are moving overseas from rural places, or they're, scaling back to just a skeleton size workforce. And so that deindustrialization, the loss of manufacturing jobs, was so huge. We did a lot of interviews in rural counties in various states. And I talked to both Republican and Democratic political party chairs in those counties. And I would ask them, how has the economy changed here? And so many of them, in either party, would just start ticking off the names of all of these plants that used to exist there that have now left, that have now gone. And it was, it was really sad to hear that, and it seemed like a major factor in what drove people towards supporting Republicans. And it's, in some ways it's somewhat puzzling why people shifted toward voting for Republicans, because Republicans had long been in favor of free trade and deregulation that was underscoring all of this. But what happened in the 90s was just enough Democrats in Congress joined them for these things to pass. And then a Democrat, President Bill Clinton, was signing them into law. And so I think it was the Democrats seemed visibly to have changed, even though most people in the Democratic Party hadn't changed. But I think rural voters were angry and upset about it, and they felt the Democratic Party had abandoned them.
Yeah, I mean, and NAFTA is still a dirty word here near where I live in Galesburg, Illinois, where a Maytag refrigerator production facility moved to Mexico in 2003. I mean, It was during that period when a lot of these changes you're talking about took place. So the data you put together really confirms a lot of the things I've seen on the ground here. I thought one of the more interesting things, looking through my notes here, you talked about how during the New Deal, Roosevelt's programs like the TVA, they seem very visible to people. And of course, you talked about how FDR, they went out and talked about these projects and identified with them. And it struck me that in recent years, some of the things that Democrats have tried during the Biden administration, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, the infrastructure bill, it didn't seem similarly connected between the projects and the visual aspect. Is there, am I right in that? I mean, how important is that? It struck me that maybe that was part of the failing of the Democratic Party in these last several years, is to not connect what they've tried to do to bring jobs to rural areas and working class voters. They haven't tried to connect that enough visually that make the connection.
I have the hunch that you're right. Late in the book, we look at a little bit at the role of public policies in rural areas. And it is true that the Biden administration did more than any presidential administration, probably since Franklin D. Roosevelt, to try to be responsive to rural places. And they had all of these place-based policies for distressed counties in, as you say, the Inflation Reduction Act. And in the CHIPS and Science Act and the infrastructure law. And yet it seems like nobody really knew about it. And I do plan in my next project to try to dig into that more deeply and find out what was happening. Was it that, policies never really got off the ground, that they didn't get administered, or was no one there to connect the dots and to say to voters, look, we have this great new policy that's helping our area. And in fact, the Democrats got this over the finish line and Joe Biden signed it into law. I don't know if it's, those things or quite what, but it is true if you go back to the New Deal that policies were so visible then. So like the Rural Electrification Administration and the Tennessee Valley Authority that brought electricity for the first time to a lot of rural areas. I mean, that's a big deal. And but it was also, it was carried out well. I was really struck in working on this book to learn how much FDR prioritized rural areas. They were really, he built a rural-urban coalition, and rural places were front and center in that coalition. He, of course, he came from a rural area himself, Dutchess County in New York State, which is not far from where I grew up. And maybe that has something to do with it, but he seemed to really understand the interdependence between rural and urban areas. He had all of these economists in his brain trust who focused on how can we help rural areas. And it was a real focus for him in so many of his policies.
Of course, I've seen anecdotal evidence in news articles that even in places that received funding from these programs that the Democrats passed under Biden, it didn't seem to change many voters. That seems at least an indication of the polarization we face. But you then move into another topic that's got local I think ramifications as well that I've seen play out here. Around here, you've seen a growing rural pushback to wind farms, what they call greenlash. And it's kind of follows along lines of what you're talking about here, this resentment that, you're taking our farm ground and shipping all the energy up into the big cities. This was the next big moment in your book that kind of came sequentially after the economic issues. If you could discuss that.
So, we find that the growth of the rural-urban divide, it doesn't emanate from one cause, but we trace out this sequence of things that happen. So you start out with the rise of place-based economic inequality, like I was talking about. Then the next phase, which is really 2008 to 2020, we call elite overreach, where rural people start to feel that the Democratic Party, the center of the party, seems to be these people who are better off than themselves, who live in cities, have a lot of education, and they create all these policies that then get foisted upon rural areas. And the interesting thing is, it's not that rural people necessarily disagree with those policies on their merits, but they feel that they don't have a voice in how they're designed or how they're going to be implemented, even when they're affecting their very own areas. So, one of the policy areas we focus in on is renewable energy. And we find that, this has happened all over the country, and there's a lot of scholars have written about this, studying cases in different areas like your own, where either wind farms or solar farms are introduced. But the way it happens is that there'll be some company that comes in, and they're going to take advantage of all these special tax credits and so on that are part of some policy. And they make a deal, they cut a deal with some big landowner in the area that, they're going to use acres and acres and acres there to set up wind or solar. And all of that happens before the local community learns about it. And then once people do, it's too late for them to do something as a community to say, well, we would like the siting to happen a little bit differently than what the plan is and under certain terms and et cetera. And so they feel really cut out of the process. And it's, I think, to a lot of urbanites, they assume, well, rural people, they're just backward. They don't know that we have climate change and we need all this renewable energy. And they'll accuse rural people of NIMBYism. But in fact, it's all of that energy has to be produced for cities. It's an extractive thing. And so unless rural people are really going to have a voice in how it's done, it's really unfair. And so, rural people, there's a lot of research that shows that on environmental issues, rural people care deeply about the environment. They're very tied to the land. They love the places where they live. But it's, as there was one person in Indiana quoted in some of this literature, really struck me. They said, "It's not that I'm against wind energy. I'm against how it was done here." And I think that is the theme that we found in this policy area and several others as well.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Suzanne Mettler, who's a co-author of an important new book called Rural versus Urban: The Growing Divide That Threatens Democracy. Her co-author is Trevor Brown, and this book just came out, and I thought it was, I just finished reading it, and I'm really glad to have Suzanne be able to take time to be a guest today because it's so relevant to what's been going on in our area here in eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois over the past 20, 30 years. And of course, that's, as listeners know, this has been a major focus of this show, is kind of figuring out what's going on in our politics. We're living through some really unprecedented times. They're scary for some people on both sides of the divide that I've talked to, but I think it's important to understand what's happened. And this book is evidence-based, a lot of research done with facts and solid research. So that's what I like about it as well. So I want to take Suzanne kind of the third leg here, which is another thing that we've seen here locally, and that's the local political organization, which this plays a role in what happened to get us to where we are, but it could also play a role in getting us healed as a country.
That's right. Yeah. So the third part of this process has to do with organizations and, which organizations are really active and vibrant in a community and, who's getting mobilized as a result and how they're getting mobilized versus what's not happening. So, both political parties, Democrats and Republicans, have atrophied over the past 60 years at the grassroots level as organizations by and large. And that's part of, the broader trend that's happened to civic organizations generally in the United States, highlighted by the book Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam back in the 90s. But political parties can be helped, though, if there are other civic organizations that kind of shore them up and do some of the work of mobilizing their voters. And the labor organizations used to do this for the Democratic Party. And you know what I think of organizations and parties doing at the grassroots level is what I call connecting the dots. They're communicating to voters and saying, here's the party that's best representing your interests and your values. And so labor organizations, you know, when industry was still doing well in a lot of rural places, labor, and particularly in the Midwest, was connecting the dots for voters and saying the Democratic Party is representing you very well, and it was helping to draw voters to support the Democrats. Then with deindustrialization and deregulation, you have labor unions suffering and atrophying in numbers. And so the Democratic Party doesn't get that assist the way it used to the same extent. But meanwhile, the Republican Party has been helped by the rise of other organizations. And so we find that evangelical churches, there are more of them per capita in rural counties than there are in urban counties. And they've become very important in recent decades in connecting the dots for voters to vote for the Republican Party. And then similarly, the same thing can be said of what I call gun groups that are affiliated with the National Rifle Association. And so, you know, these are where I live, these are called rod and gun clubs. They have different kinds of names, different parts of the country. And, you know, if people buy guns, they have to go get training somewhere in, you know, shooting properly. And so these organizations provide it. And along the way, people hear, well, the Republican Party is representing the interests of gun owners. And so those connections are made. So that kind of cements the rural-urban divide by mobilizing people.
I did this purposely to kind of just get the three major ideas you're talking about that have happened that occurred that sequentially that kind of get us to where we are, but and this could be the most important question of the whole book, but I wanted to provide that foundation. But how does this threaten democracy in your subtitle? I think we see evidence of it, but this seems to be a function of what's happened. What do you see as the major threat here?
Yeah, well, we think that it endangers democracy in various ways. It's creating a kind of us versus them politics in the United States. And you know, that's another way of saying polarization. But it's really dangerous. It's particularly problematic given that it's geographic. So, you know, if you there are various kinds of polarization that can happen along other lines. But if you live in an area where you're coming into contact with people of the other party, political scientists have long thought, you know, that's a good thing because it breaks down those walls between people. Say that, you know, you grow up in a family where everybody's a Democrat, but you go to a workplace or a church or synagogue or civic organization where you're encountering lots of Republicans, and then you realize, well, you know, they might vote differently than you, but they're actual human beings just like you, and you know, you can actually get along in various ways, and it breaks down those divides. With the geographic aspect of the rural-urban divide, people are less likely to have all of those encounters, and so what we find in some of these survey questions that we look at, they're called feeling thermometers, where people rate different groups of people on a scale of 0 to 100. And we find now that the antipathy to people in the other party is very high, and it's really high between rural and urban people, of rural people really disliking urban Democrats and urban people really disliking rural Republicans in this very strong way. That's dangerous for democracy. So that's the first thing. Second, in rural areas, this is creating one party politics, and that's really problematic. You know, it can mean at a minimum that people don't have the same kind of choice in elections, and you don't get the accountability loop happening where, you know, voters can elect somebody, And then if they end up being disappointed by that person's willingness to really represent the area, they can vote the bums out. They can, vote for the other party. But if the other party isn't even able to field candidates or, is not a viable contender, then it's not meaningful democracy. But worse than that, of course, one party government can lead to corruption because, nobody's watching the other party and really challenging them. And then, the third area in which the rural-urban divide hurts democracy is that if we look at the nation as a whole, we have always had these electoral institutions that give extra clout to less populated places. So if you think of the US Senate, for example, every state gets two senators regardless of population. And so California has more than 60 times the population of Wyoming, but they both get two senators. And so that gives an outsized voice to rural states. Well, now you have one party dominating not only, the ability to win in the Senate, but all of these other arrangements as well. We've never had that before in our history in the United States. It used to be in the past that one party dominated in some rural areas and the other party in other rural areas, so they checked each other. But now you've got one party getting this systematic advantage in rural places nationwide. And so you can have, policy decisions and judicial appointments made by people representing a minority of Americans.
We just have 1 minute left, and I to try to ask this final question. But I think the hopeful part is that you're calling what one of the solutions you're talking about is kind of a return to democracy, small d. If you could, in just 45 seconds, kind of encapsulate that for me.
Yes. Yeah, this is where we end up. We think that what's most important, what really needs to happen, is that the Democratic Party needs to reach out to rural areas, needs to hire long-term, full-time organizers, people from rural places who can be listening in rural areas and trying to build relationships. And it's going to take time because there's a lot of mistrust of the Democratic Party. But this kind of organizing, grassroots organizing, we think is fundamental. And it's the way to overcome that us versus them politics, to reintroduce having two-party competition in rural places, and to really revitalize democracy.
And on the flip side, in fairness, and you mentioned this, is it would be good for the Republicans to be more active in big cities too, because we have one party rule there. I live in Illinois, and we, the Democrats control things in Iowa, the Republicans do. So it's an interesting laboratory. But this goes both ways, that I think we need more competition both ways, and more. It's going to start from the bottom up. And I really believe that. So your findings kind of go along with what my thoughts are on it as well, which is nice. But Suzanne, thank you so much for being a guest today. Suzanne Mettler is the co-author of an important new book called Rural versus Urban, The Growing Divide That Threatens Democracy. The co-author is Trevor Brown. Again, a book that when you read, you'll be noting a lot of similarities to what's been going on here in the Quad Cities region on both sides of the river. Suzanne, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.